I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Sina Kahan, author of the fascinating new book, Ideas, Bereshit. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. It's less than 2 weeks before what will be the most unusual Rosh Hashanah most of us have experienced in our entire lives. Instead of gathering in our finest clothing to welcome the new Jewish year in the synagogue, inviting family and friends to big meals in our homes, and hugging and kissing everybody we know at shul, we are mostly headed for Zoom services or Facebook viewings in our dining rooms, socially distanced dinners in backyards, phone calls or FaceTime connections to wish each other L'Shana Tova, and elbow-to-elbow greetings in person. While it's a central mitzvah, a commandment of Rosh Hashanah, to hear the shofar blasts in person, this year we'll be hearing them through our laptop's tinny internal speakers, or perhaps our Bluetooth noise-canceling headphones. And as for sharing kiddush and honey cake and apples and honey after services, well, if it's happening, it's in our breakfast room. You know, most Jewish holidays are centered around the home and don't lose nearly as much as the High Holy Days do by being exiled from the synagogue, as most of us will find ourselves this 5781 New Year. You can light Shabbat candles, have kiddush and a lovely Sabbath meal with your family, do Birkat HaMazon, the grace after meal, sing Zmirot, songs of Shabbat joy to your heart's content, all at home. The Passover Seder is meant to be held in every Jewish home. Hanukkah candles highlight a home-based festival as well. Sukkot, coming just after Yom Kippur, is enjoyed in a temporary booth in our yards, sitting outside with friends and family. But the High Holy Days are not so home-based. Sure, you can invite family and friends for Rosh Hashanah dinner before or after evening services, and it's nice to gather for a meal after the longer Rosh Hashanah morning services. And I know people who spend all of Yom Kippur setting up their homes for a break the fast meal and never make it to shul to offer their own prayers for forgiveness. But the essence of the High Holy Days is what happens at the temple. And this year, most people can't go to temple, or synagogue, or shul, or their congregation at all. So, how will we compensate for this? There are lots of interesting things going on out there in Jewish cyberspace this fall to help Jews connect when we can't actually do so in person. Some congregations actually pre-recorded their entire services, including music and sermons, in fancy recording studios so they could create the best TV show possible for their congregants. In other words, back in July or August, they went into sound and video booths and, well, faked the whole Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur experience. I'm not sure exactly what the rabbis and cantors who did this will be doing on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur itself. Vacationing in the Caribbean? Lip-syncing at home to their Zoom or YouTube images? Playing air guitar in their kitchens? But it reminds me of a sermon I once did comparing the Jewish High Holy Days to the then-new phenomenon of reality TV shows. You know, for 10 days, you dress up and work really hard to make sure you aren't voted off the island in the coming year by God, you know, and so on. Well, these pre-recorded High Holy Day services take the reality TV show motif even further, since they, in fact, the reality TV shows are also pre-recorded and largely fake, just like these High Holy Day services are. No doubt the music will be lovely. Auto-tune is a handy music studio tool to make every choir sound spot on and every cantor hit the high notes perfectly. And with multiple takes, I'll bet the rabbis never give the wrong page or screw up a single word or phrase of their sermons. But isn't something altogether lost when live prayer becomes pre-recorded video studio performance? Why not just watch last year's recorded HD service and substitute a new sermon about coronavirus? Or shop around for the best produced High Holy Day broadcast you can find online, regardless if you know anyone involved. Anyway, for those of us who haven't given in to the, we can have perfect High Holy Day services with great studio musicians and vocalists if we just record Kol Nidre on July 22nd trend, we've had to be a little more innovative in our approaches. Some congregations are delivering no-contact honey cake and High Holy Day machzers to congregants. Some are offering, as we are at my congregation Beit Simcha, blended services in which a small number of masked congregants can join in the sanctuary while others participate in a live stream. Some are holding outdoors, socially distanced services in climates conducive to that. We've come up with one unique idea at my synagogue, Congregation Beit Simcha. On Saturday night, September 19th at 7:30 p.m., we'll hold a drive-in Rosh Hashanah celebration at the Gaslight Theater North. We can accommodate 100 cars for an in-person, safe, socially distanced program of great music, inspiration, prayer, live shofar, I mean live, hygienically distributed honey cake, and a chance to see and hear in person, in 3D, a full Rosh Hashanah fun experience. We'll have big video boards so everybody can see, professional sound so everybody can hear, and great leaders, I say modestly, to bring in the 5781 new year, which we hope and fervently pray will be a whole lot better than 5780 has proven to be. Our hope is that everybody in our Jewish community wants to be part of this, in person. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675 to sign up for this unique drive-in celebration of the Jewish New Year. To play us in this morning, a little more traditionally, is a preview of the coming High Holy Days. Here's cantor Moshe Stern singing the famous section of a central prayer from the High Holy Days, Berosh Hashanah. On Rosh Hashanah it's written, on Yom Kippur it's sealed, who shall live and who shall die, who by fire, who by water, who by war, who by beast, who by earthquake, and who by disease. This year especially, perhaps, who by disease.
Oh, yeah.
That was the magnificent cantor Moshe Stern, a true cantorial masterpiece, Berosh Hashanah. When we return in a moment here on Two Jewish, our guest, Sina Kahan, a brilliant young scholar and author, brings a fresh perspective to the very first book of all Western religion with his new book, Bereishit Ideas. Find out what's completely unique about his approach and him when we come back in a moment on Two Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, a new Jewish synagogue, the House of Joy in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events and high holy days this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the whole metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. The High Holy Days will be here soon. Join Beit Simcha for our blended online and very limited live seating. Call 520-276-5675 or email rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA. And don't miss our live drive-in second night celebration at the Gaslight, September 19th, with music, shofar, and much more, led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. And this Saturday night, Slichot events begin on Facebook Live and Zoom at 8 p.m. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. In normal times, well, everything's open to everyone, but in these days of coronavirus sorus, join us Friday night on our Facebook page. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30. Saturday morning Shabbat services are at 10 a.m. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson. We'll hold our services with full music by virtual experience weekly on the Sabbath for the time being. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are either on Zoom or blended, both live and Zoom. You can access them by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to sign up for our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Confirmation and High School program, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, all taught through Zoom and some blended, and of course our services on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. For high holiday information, that's the same number, 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish synagogue in southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years and its second Rosh Hashanah coming up fast. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish this morning. Our guest, Sina Kahan, is a, as he puts it himself, an Orthodox Jew from London who has published a new book called Ideas Bereishit, a very interesting book, a commentary. Well, we'll let him tell you about it. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Hello, hello. Thank you very much for having me.
You start your book with a very interesting kind of explanation of your Sephardic heritage and really Sephardic study of Torah. Why did you decide to do that?
Growing up in a very traditional Orthodox Sephardi community really here in London, originally born in Iran, I noticed that contemporary Sephardi Judaism tends to be quite superstitious. It has a lot of irrationality within not only some of the practices, some of the beliefs, correlating to many things from the mitzvot, the commandments, to divine providence, Hashgacha Pratit. And there was always this debate between secular studies versus, holy studies, lack of a better term.
Is it, you know, sort of Torah im derech eretz, you know, that classic division?
Yes, absolutely. And then we see it in the Ashkenazi world as well, in some circles, where there's this debate about, you know, this false dichotomy that's really put out there. And of course, there are some things that are healthy education, there are some things that are unhealthy education. And I started to look through the history of the Sfaradi Hachamim, Sfaradi rabbis, and to see how these guys were not just leaders in Talmudic study, they were not just leaders in Tanakhic study, but they were leaders in the field of logic, sciences, philosophy, mathematics, and natural sciences, especially within the medieval era. And I decided to look into their words, look into the controversies that really occurred during their time with regards to this very debate between secular and holy study, and to see how they dealt with it, and what are the lessons we can take from those Hachamim that I think are pertinent for us even today. And I really started the book trying to dig into one of the controversies that occurred between the Sephardim and the Ashkenazim, and how that really plays out even on today's Jewish theme.
It's a fascinating approach. You know, Maimonides did the same thing a really long time ago. Most Ashkenazim are familiar with Rambam's attempts to harmonize Plato and Aristotle with Jewish thought and with rationality. It's fascinating that we've sort of come full circle, and now we sort of need to do it again, don't we?
This is a very interesting point you've raised, because a lot of people like to call Rambam Aristotelian, or they like to call other rabbis, they could be, you know, very, very influenced by Plato, influenced by Al-Farabi, etc., etc.
I should note that you start your book really with a quote from Plato.
Indeed, I do. One of the things I always like to say is that when we got to remove the Plato, Aristotle, all these names, it's about reality. At the end of the day, these are rabbis that were looking at the reality of their time. They were looking at the studies of their time, the scientific knowledge, the philosophical knowledge that was cutting edge at their time. And because they believe that the author of the world and the author of the Torah, for all intents and purposes, are one and the same, there could be no contradiction between the reality that they knew at their time and the Torah, which is why it wasn't that they were trying to essentially force these two worlds. They really saw them as one and the same. So in every generation, I think the role of the rabbi, if they do hold that the author of the world and the author of Torah, the message of the Torah, is the same, therefore there has to be that integrationist effort, as opposed to an isolationist effort, which deems everything outside the house of learning, the Beit HaMidrash, as an elaborate distraction from Torah, rather sees everything outside of the Beit HaMidrash, as my Rebbe, Rabbi Dweck, says, as an elaborate expression of God. And whether it's Plato, Aristotle, whether it's today Yuval Harari or Sam Harris or Elon Musk, it doesn't really matter. It's more to do with the fact that we have to have rabbis dealing with the reality of the day and seeing how it is compatible with the eternal message of our Holy Torah.
Great introduction. We will talk much more with Sina Kahen when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, with over 100,000 downloads. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, you had a really interesting experience a few weeks ago talking about the Torah portion of Shoftim, which has to do with judges and justice and has importance whether it's that week or any week.
And police work.
And police and officers and
right.
magistrates and all of it.
Right. So I have wonderful Orthodox friends who live in Seattle, and from their kitchen table, you have this picture postcard view of Mount Rainier. And from their back deck where we sit out to eat during Shabbat, you have a view over Lake Washington. You can see Mercer Island in the distance. It's fabulously peaceful, restful, and therapeutic. The problem is their synagogue is located up a very steep hill. And it's like not that far a walk, but it's 20 minutes of continuous uphill, like on one of the steepest street of San Francisco.
I'm so sorry.
I have trouble doing that and often don't go when I'm there. So this was one of those cases, but I did study the portion of the week. And the only thing international about this one show of ours is that I get commentaries on the portion of the week from rabbis all over the world in like five or six different countries. And none of them really did. First of all, many of them chose to duck the question altogether. And those who addressed it didn't address it to my satisfaction. And the question is, in that portion, Shoftim, we read that if you find a dead person on the roadside, unidentified, unknown,
John Doe,
in a random place,
right,
doesn't specify whether it's a Jew or a non-Jew, whether it's, okay, foreigner or local or whatever, you measure the distance from the corpse to the nearest two or three villages. And whichever one is closest, or city, or town, whatever, whichever agglomeration of people is closest has to take responsibility for this murder. And they have to assemble three elders to kill a red heifer in a nearby wadi where there's rushing water in the right season, but where there's never cultivation or plowing because of the nature of a wadi, which here is called a wash.
That's right, same thing.
Although in Israel, they're usually steeper than here. In any case, the only person I read who explained this to my satisfaction was Nechama Leibovich, great female Talmudist.
Whom I studied with in Jerusalem long ago.
Right.
Great teacher.
And who really broke into a field that is normally considered the domain of men, being a Talmud teacher.
Well, she taught Talmud, but her greatest accomplishment was her commentaries on Torah, which are
right.
at a very high level of Parshanut.
Which I just received the complete edition of yesterday from Amazon.com from this friend who was so pleased that I liked her so much.
That he sent you
the books
whole thing.
Got here before I did.
That's great.
Anyway, what she says is highly relevant to our times, which is the following. So whatever the nearest village is can be presumed to be the village from which this traveler, wanderer, whatever, started out. And it might be the responsibility of the village to give him an escort to protect a human life, which is the greatest mitzvah of them all. Conversely, we shouldn't be only focused on the dead man. We should also focus on the killer. And it might be the responsibility of that community to make sure that the person who killed has enough to eat and that robbery wasn't a motive in order to feed his family or has decent health care so that he didn't need to steal from a wanderer in order to pay a doctor.
To pay for a doctor, right.
So her point was basically we're all responsible for each other, and that includes stuff like making sure people don't go hungry, making sure people don't have to go without health care, and making sure that travelers are safe.
And that everyone is treated equally under the law, an incredibly important principle in that same section. Tom, thanks very much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. When samurai were the elite warriors of Japan, there was a powerful emperor. He needed a new chief samurai. There were three finalists for the job: a Japanese samurai, a Chinese samurai, and a Jewish samurai. The emperor asked the Japanese samurai to demonstrate why he should be the chief samurai. The Japanese samurai opened a matchbox and out popped a bumblebee. Whoosh went his sword, and the bumblebee dropped dead on the ground in two pieces, evenly split. The emperor exclaimed, "That is impressive." The Chinese samurai then came in to demonstrate why he should be chosen. Chinese samurai also opened a little box. Out buzzed a fly. Whoosh, whoosh went his sword. The fly dropped dead on the ground in four evenly cut pieces. The emperor exclaimed, "That is really very impressive." Next, the emperor turned to the Jewish samurai and asked him also to demonstrate why he should be the head samurai. The Jewish samurai opened his matchbox and out flew a gnat. His sword flashed and went whoosh, but the gnat was still flying around. The emperor exclaimed with disappointment, "But the gnat's alive." And the Jewish samurai smiled and said, "Circumcision is not meant to kill." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. How do we go about changing our world? And how long should it take? This week we celebrate the final Shabbat of the year, which means our Torah portion is one of the great sections of the whole year, Nitzavim Vayelech. You stand here today, the Torah says, all of you, oldest to youngest, wealthiest to poorest, most famous to the humblest, leaders of your community and strangers visiting with you. You are all part of the covenant with the Lord your God, you and every other generation to come who will be descended from you. This great brit, this covenant, affirms that you will be God's people and God will be your Lord. This universal covenant establishes that we are part of a profound and eternal tradition, a connection to our ancestors that will be carried forward to our descendants. Each of us, all of us, are part of this remarkable compact. It's an extraordinarily democratic and egalitarian agreement with God, a brit shared with everyone regardless of gender or age. Children and women stand with men, not always the case at the time of the Torah, or sometimes today. So what's the content of the mitzvah, the commandment that we are now to observe? At the climax of our portion, we are told, Ki ha-mitzvah hazot asher nachim etzavcha hayom lo nifleit hi mimcha. Look, this commandment that I command you today, it's not so awesome for you. It's not beyond your reach. It's not in the heavens that you should say, who among us can go up to the heavens and take it and teach it to us that we may do it? It's not across the sea that you should say, who among us can cross over the sea and bring it back to us that we may do it? No, it's very close to you. It's already in your mouth and in your heart to do it. Rabbi Lawrence Kushner says, the Torah is not somewhere else. It's in us. We're made of it. Torah is already coded into our DNA. That's why it feels good to live by the Torah, the way of all being. We're just doing what we've been designed to do from the very beginning. Perhaps the mitzvah, the commandment Nitzavim speaks about, is no more than becoming aware of the presence of Torah in our midst, or more precisely, of the presence of God in the here and now. In this season, we prepare for tshuva, our repentance. But if God is here right now, tshuva is a way of becoming aware that Torah is in our mouths and hearts. Kushner adds, this may be the mother of all mitzvot, of all commandments, for all the other commandments are merely human refractions of this one mitzvah, being aware of God's constant presence. Tshuva simply means God saying, return to me. Again, become aware of me always being in your life. A great thing to remember as we approach Rosh Hashanah, and always. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Sina Kahen, will explore the meaning of the primal book of Judaism, well, indeed of all Western religion, find out what's also incredibly new about his perspective on Genesis, one of the oldest books, when we return on Too Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A truly historic flight took place last week, an El Al round trip from Tel Aviv to Abu Dhabi, nonstop. This was the first flight between Israel and the United Arab Emirates to take place following the normalization agreement between the two countries. The passengers on board included Israeli National Security Advisor Meir Ben Shabbat, U.S. National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, and U.S. President Senior Advisor Jared Kushner. We take it as a sign, Kushner said. It's an encouragement for this progress. The flight traveled through Saudi Arabian airspace, another first for El Al. By the way, on board was an El Al flight attendant flying her final flight before retirement. Nice way to go out. In follow-up news, the World Zionist Organization will send permanent emissaries to the Jewish community in the United Arab Emirates for the first time. That announcement came the day after the flight came back. A young married couple will be the pioneer emissaries for the WIZO. They will establish and run a Jewish kindergarten, teach about Jewish heritage in Israel and the UAE, and establish an olpan for learning Hebrew while organizing community events around the Jewish festivals. In recent months, WZO has been in touch with the Jewish community in Dubai and begun to prepare shluchim emissaries. Those emissaries are part of the Ben Ami program of the Center for Religious Affairs in the Diaspora of the WIZO, WZO, which has 36 such emissaries operating in 23 countries with small, dispersed Jewish communities. Also last week, the Jewish Agency for Israel and Keren HaYesod, an Israeli humanitarian group, announced that they would begin providing services to the UAE Jewish community, which is estimated at over 1,000. In U.S. presidential campaign news, Carly Kloss, the wife of Joshua Kushner, Jared Kushner's brother, is helping out Joe Biden's presidential campaign. Kloss, the supermodel who converted to Judaism in the process of marrying Joshua Kushner, joined Vice President Biden and Reshama Soljani, founder of the Girls Who Code nonprofit, for an event encouraging young women to succeed at STEAM, science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics, a favorite cause of Carly Kloss. A couple of weeks ago, President Trump, reading from a teleprompter or cue cards or something, misread Yosemite National Park as Yosemites, not once but twice, as we reported here. We had Sarah Lefton on a couple weeks ago for her Yosemite t-shirt business, which went through the roof after that, unsurprisingly. And now we have a musical addition to the Yosemite lore from songster Cy Khan.
When they gaze upon Yosemites, Yosemites...
Yosemite? Wait, I got it. It's a shout out for us. Yosemite! I've got some news for you. It's finally okay to be an American Jew. He spoke in front of four real presidents. Every word was covered. I haven't been this happy since bagels were discovered. Yosemite, have you heard the news? Our saintly Christian president gave a shout out to us Jews. But better wait a minute before you jump for joy. If you spell yo backwards, what you get is oi. He could have said yo Baptist, could have said yo Sikh. He could say, yo, Buddhist, every time he speaks. He could have said, Yoruba, but on that sacred day, in front of all the cameras, what did he choose to say? Yosemite, have you heard the news? Our saintly Christian president gave a shout out to us Jews, but better wait a minute before you jump for joy. If you spell yo backwards, what you get is oi, oi. This is the season, these high holy days. We gather in the synagogue to sing our songs of praise. Then on Yom Kippur, we hear those holy words. But the greatest celebration will come November 3rd. What a joy that day will be. We'll sing and dance and shout. So go get your mail-in ballot. It's time to vote him out. Yosemite, have you heard the news? Our saintly Christian president gave a shout out to us Jews. But better wait a minute before you jump for joy. If you spell yo backwards, what you get is oi, oi gefault. Weisbier, oi vey.
Yo backwards is indeed oi. Thanks to Saigon for permission to use that song. In other news, arson was the cause of a disastrous fire at the Chabad Center at the University of Delaware. The state's fire marshal ruled. Investigators found no indication of a hate crime yet. The fire marshal's office, however, is exploring all avenues. A criminal investigation has been opened. Damage from last week's blaze is estimated at $175,000. A group of students calling themselves Students of Chabad UD launched a GoFundMe campaign to help rebuild. As of last week, they raised about $25,000 from 650 donors. Chabad at UD is a home away from home for many Jewish students at the University of Delaware. Each week, they open their doors for Shabbat dinners and programs such as holiday celebrations and learning opportunities. This campaign is run by the students of Chabad. The least we can do to kickstart the larger campaign to be rolled out shortly. Classes at the University of Delaware are scheduled to start next week. It is heartbreaking to learn the fire at the Chabad Center was set intentionally, said Newark Mayor Jerry Clifton. This is a sickening act of hostility that threatens the safety and security of our inclusive, welcoming neighborhoods. My thoughts are with the Jewish community and those affected by this tragedy. The Chabad Jewish Center on the other end of the country, in Portland, Oregon, caught fire twice last week, although the cause of those blazes is still unknown. And in Israel, for one day at least, it rained marijuana. A drone hovering over Tel Aviv last week dropped hundreds of tiny bags containing cannabis, mostly around Rabin Square. Tel Avivians rushed in to scoop up the bags bearing the labels with the words "Free Love" inside a green heart. The drop was courtesy of a popular instant messaging Telegram group named Green Glider that calls for the legalization of recreational drugs. An announcement of the Cannabis Rain Project drops on the Telegram channel said that 1 kilo of cannabis divided into 2-gram bags will be dropped every week in a different part of the country. The drone drops were conceived as part of an effort to figure out how to get marijuana to consumers in a new way because of the coronavirus crisis. Police arrested 2 men in their 30s who allegedly operated the drone, and the Israeli police are accusing them of drug trafficking. Or in this case, of giving a drug away. I'm not sure whether that charge will stick. Tie stick? Anyway, that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Sina Kahan has written really a fascinating commentary on Genesis from a very unique perspective called Ideas Breishit. We spoke at the beginning of the show about the harmonization of rationality and really scholarship in all of its breadth. You actually quoted one of my favorite authors, Yuval Noah Harari, whose book Sapiens, I think, is one of the really great books in recent years. When you do a commentary, because you only have done Breishit so far, so I'm assuming you're going to do more down the road, you really try to bring together all of scholarship. And in particular, I think you cite a number of authorities that people may not be familiar with. Tell us a little bit about how you approach a parsha, a Torah portion.
Absolutely. So really, the tradition of classical Sephardi relative to contemporary Sephardi was very much to see the world as an elaborate expression of God. Therefore, all of the knowledge that was out there, whether it's science, philosophy, art, history, it really has its place in Talmud Torah, in the study and learning of Torah. So what I try to do is really look at the weekly portions of Bereshit, and as you mentioned, I will be doing so for Shemot and the following books of the Torah, and see, you know, as the beautiful verse, beautiful line in the Talmud states that, you know, one verse is expressed in the Torah and its 70 interpretations come out of it. I try to see, based on the cutting edge knowledge that we have today, the cutting edge science, philosophical investigations that have been taking place in our generation, how can we apply it to the message or a message that comes out of the parasha text of the week? And as you go through it, it's fascinating to see that so much of parasha interpretation doesn't need to be forced. It almost screams out at you based on the knowledge that you have of the time. that these ideas that are cutting edge today, you can find a lot of the same messages within the Torah, and really try to bring them out to provide an understanding of Torah that's very much based on the intellect, very much based on integrating current knowledge with the Torah, as opposed to superstition and isolating oneself from the world around us. And that was really the objective that I had, and thank God I stand on the shoulders of, you know, Sephardi and Ashkenazi giants who have done the same throughout history, from, as you mentioned, Rambam, Radak, Rav David Kimchi, the Eben Ezra, all the way to contemporary Hachamim, both in the Sephardi and Ashkenazi world, that are endeavoring to do the same. An Ashkenazi example, obviously, would be Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, former Chief Rabbi of the United Kingdom, and the current Sephardi Chief Rabbi of the United Kingdom, who is my Rebbe, Rabbi Joseph Dweck, who is, of course, doing the same thing on the Sephardi side. So that was really the objective that I had for it, and it's something that I'm hoping will be embraced with open arms and a lot of criticism as well. Of course, you can't just go with positivity.
All right, I'm going to ask you a weird question. What's your favorite parsha on Bereishit? What's your favorite Torah portion?
I would have to say, as cliche as it sounds, it would have to be Bereishit, because I think what we see from Bereishit is the most fundamental lesson that we can take as humans, which is, what is it that separates us from other mammals? At the end of the day, we've been through an evolutionary development for so many millions of years, billions of years. And what is it that makes us distinct? What is it that is allowing us to have this conversation, to think about existence itself? And it is, as far as Bereishit goes, the intellect. It is our capacity to not just be aware of our surroundings, but to be aware that we're aware of our surroundings. So we're conscious of being conscious. And the intellect, as it says in Bereishit, is, you know, B'tzelem Elokim, the image of God. The Sephardi Chachamim interpreted the image of God as meaning the rational faculty, the intellectual faculty. And when you understand that this is a distinctive feature between a human and other mammals, you understand that the purpose really that we're here is to ensure that we utilize the intellect in a lot of the things that we do, not just for our day-to-day life, but especially when we are relating to the works of rabbinic literature, Torah literature that are out there. And I think we're lacking that in a lot of corners in Judaism, where the intellect is almost seen as something that the more it's suppressed and the more irrational our faith is, the closer we are to piety and truth. But it couldn't be further from the truth, according to a lot of, as I said, the Sephardi Hachamim, especially with the medieval period, going all the way back to the Gaonim in Babylonia, when the Talmud Bavli was being formulated, that actually intellect should be the driving force, almost the vanguard of everything that we do. Beyond intellect, beyond rationality, of course, we have a supra-rational realm. There are things that are beyond intellect. We have to have the experiential side of our existence. But I think that experience has to be rooted in a grounded reality, in a rationality and an intellectual faculty that is very much connected to the reality around us.
So I want to ask you about that, because at the end of your commentary on Bereishit, you say supra-rational phenomena are beyond our understanding, not beneath it. The Torah itself is beyond rationality, not against it. And then you quote Chacham Yosefar, the Torah does not contradict rationality, it transcends it. What does that mean?
So there is a lack of a clear distinction in contemporary Jewish and other religious circles between supra-rationality and irrationality. In other words, there are certain things that we cannot explain. So person A may take the fact that there are certain unexplainable things and use it as a ticket to explain things irrationality, things in a way that is illogical or unreasonable. However, person B, and as I said, this is very much the Mesorah, the tradition of classical rationalist Jewish thinkers, would say, okay, there are certain things that are unexplainable, but they don't have to counter reality. They don't have to counter our reasoning faculties and our rationality. They are beyond our understanding. So an example that I try to give is love. We know that love is experiential. We can reduce love into its components, such as vasopressin, oxytocin, dopamine, but there is something that emerges from those ingredients that is love and cannot really be explained, because you can go and put these three molecules in a lab, but they won't produce love. So when I say transcends rationality, it's that there are certain things we might come across in the Torah that may seem, this is very strange. It's not something that we can explain, but that does not mean that we tag it with irrational, illogical explanations. We have to try and see what is the limit of our understanding And beyond that limit, there are certain things that we have to put our hands up and try to put in the realm of this emergent experience that rationality just cannot touch upon. And there are many things, as I said, in the irreligious world that fit that area as well. This non-materialistic, purely materialistic world is not something that I believe the classical Jewish approach really tied into.
You're really taking an ultra-rational approach, and yet there's a level beyond it, which, is that a question of us simply not having the science or the knowledge yet?
So I guess asked this a lot. I've been asked a few times. Are you basically saying, Sina? Are you basically saying that, you know, we have this God of the gaps, where because we don't understand things, we just say, hey, this is just a super rational realm? No, I think it's much deeper than that. I think at the end of the day, the human mind, it's very limited in its capacity, very limited. As vast and as incredible as it is, there are certain things that are beyond the remit of human understanding. Now, as I try to stress, that reality does not mean that we should be irrational beings. There is irrational faith and there is supra-rational faith. And irrational faith, as I said, is not grounded in reality, whereas supra-rational faith says, look, I will do my hishtadlut, my effort, to the best of my intellectual and experiential capacity. But there is something beyond that hishtadlut, that effort, that I've got to leave for this abstract hope, faith, whatever you want to call it, to really drive the motivation of everyone's life. And I think in a world where you see things just in the purely rational, so I would say I'm not ultra-rational, I would say I'm very much a post-rationalist. And I think that's how Rambam was. People like to think Rambam is very rationalist, but no, he was very much a post-rationalist, because if you remember, he said that Aristotle was this level before prophecy. Why? Aristotle right. was the clearest of rationalism.
But then you have to move into Nevuha, right? That's correct.
Indeed, indeed. So it's post-rationality, not irrationality and not ultra-rationality. And I think the misunderstanding of these terms has led to this false dichotomy of rationality versus mysticism, as though they are on opposing sides. But actually, it's about different stages of being. You cannot have mysticism before rationality. The mysticism must be grounded in a rational understanding of the world that God created.
Yeah, I've always thought that when you dig deep into Mora Nevuchim, when you get to the kind of the peak of the text, you're dealing with rationality becoming mysticism.
Indeed. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And the reason why Rambam is really referred to as being this ultra-rationalist is because he was surrounded by so many irrational ideas. He was dealing with communities that essentially believe that when God has a hand in the Torah, it states that they believe that he actually has a hand.
All the anthropomorphism of the time, right.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. So it's really much deeper than taking the plain sense of things, as with anything else in life.
So I have a question for you. You're so brilliant. You have such a command of the sources. What do you do for a living?
Yes. So this is the amount of times I interviewed and I referred to as rabbi, and I'm like, no, I haven't got semicha. So I'm actually in the medtech and AI world. So I'm an innovation manager for a medtech company. But I also have a voiced technology, conversational AI-based startup here in London, spending a lot of time trying to see how is it that AI can improve consumer interactions with brands, and as well as improving healthcare within the operating room. So that's really my full-time work, if you like.
No, it's good to have another source of income. I think that's very important in this world. And artificial intelligence is a fascinating field. I'm going to ask you a question about that. Artificial intelligence has been around for 70 years, perhaps. Started in the 1950s. It's taken a very long time to be really practical. Is that because it's very difficult to create how human minds work? Or is there something divine that's beyond the capacity of AI?
Great question. It really boils down to, I think, two things. One is that we're still understanding things about the brain. And if we're trying to, if we summarize or define AI as being the mimicking of what it is that the brain does, it's very hard to mimic something that you don't fully understand yet. And as neuroscience develops, neurobiology develops, we're learning more and more about the brain. And as we're learning about it, we are then able to take those learnings and develop these AI systems that, for all intents and purposes, are there to mimic the brain. And that's why we've had this delay, because obviously we've been learning more and more about the brain. Secondly, a fundamental element of our existence is emotional intelligence. We love to talk about IQ. We love to talk about, you know, someone who can calculate the most complicated mathematical equation. But actually, to understand an emotion, to sense it, and then to manage an emotion is a whole game, is a whole challenge in and of itself. And we're still learning how emotional intelligence works. And no artificial intelligence will be complete until you have emotional intelligence. We just know how fundamental emotional intelligence is, even when we think of relationships. You can be in relationships with no EQ, no emotional intelligence, and that relationship will fail. Likewise, an AI system that does not have the capacity to sense and understand the emotions of the user will also fail. And that's where we come to consciousness. This is the one area that just we're not even able to touch yet with regards to developing it, because we still don't understand it. Consciousness seems to be exactly what I referred to earlier as love, which is, it is something that emerges out of ingredients. It is not defined by its constituent parts, it cannot be formed by its constituent parts, and it cannot be explained by its constituent parts. It is something that emerges, and we just cannot, we don't know where to start. Because it's such a distinctive feature. Because as I said, you know, other animals have certain levels of consciousness, but to be conscious of being conscious is something unique to humans. And there's something in the realm of the divine, I certainly believe, that consciousness taps into. And it's something unique that we are endeavoring. People way above my pay grade and intellectual grade are spending a lot of time trying to define and determine, but we'll get there. But I think there is always going to be a level of untouchable, as it says. There's always going to be something we can't touch.
I hope so, because that really makes it B'Tselem Elohim, that we are created in the image of God, that there's something beyond. There are more things thought of in this world than are dreamt of in your philosophy, Horatio. I want to thank Sina Kahan for a fabulous visit here on Two Jewish. His book is called Ideas Bereishit. It is not only a really fascinating commentary, but a very accessible one with a rich trove of ideas. Where can people find out more about you, and where can people find the book?
Thank you very much. So the book is actually available on Amazon. So if you just search Ideas Bereshit, or Sina Kahan, my name, you'd see it there. And on my website, Sina Kahan, SinaKahen.com. It's available there as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our playout comes from the upcoming High Holy Days, now less than 2 weeks away. Don't forget to make arrangements to attend High Holy Day services at Congregation Beit Simcha with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, this year. Call 520-276-5675 or email rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. And join us for our virtual Slichot service and study this coming Saturday night at 8 p.m. with our program, Finding God in Pandemic. Our playout is Naomi Shemer's lovely song, Barosh Hashanah. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Two Jewish will be Susan Shapiro Barish, whose pen name is Susanna Marin, author of the new book, A Palm Beach Scandal. My friends, have a healthy week. God willing, a Shavua Tov and a good week, a week we pray of peace.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.